Tuesday, November 26, 2013. I'm Albert Mohler, and this is The Briefing, a daily analysis of news and events from a Christian worldview. Does the Obama administration's contraception mandate violate religious liberty and the United States Constitution? That's a big question, a question that arises today at the United States Supreme Court. The background to this is the fact that under the Obamacare legislation, the Affordable Care Act, the Obama administration required, through its Department of Health and Human Services, that all employers, with a very few religious exceptions, offer without cost to all women employees a full range of benefits and health coverage, including birth control pills, and certain medications that under certain conditions may function as an abortifacient. This has led to a classic moral question that, in essence, is a constitutional question. The Supreme Court has to decide today if it's going to take the case, if it's going to hear the case and then render a decision. In all likelihood, it will decide to do so. It's almost certain that it will do so, if for no other reason than there are two big factors at stake. The first is, this is a very important constitutional question, and the Supreme Court, as the highest court in the land, is where these huge constitutional questions eventually are decided. The Supreme Court cannot shirk that responsibility. The second reason is, if anything, more pressing, and that is that there are now conflicting decisions at the highest appellate level short of the U.S. Supreme Court. The particular case that now arrives for the question of whether or not the court will take it is the case that is associated with a corporation known as Hobby Lobby. Hobby Lobby is a corporation based in Oklahoma. It is headed by people who identify themselves explicitly as evangelical Christians, the Green family. The Green family has said that it violates their religious convictions to have to offer the full range of birth control that might include abortifacients to their employees. They are not covered as a corporation by the narrow exemption for religious organizations under the current mandate from the Obama administration. Therefore, they have appealed to the courts. The U.S. District Court ruled against them, but the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals ruled in their favor. This now sets up the situation in which the Obama administration, through its Solicitor General, is now requesting that the Supreme Court take the case in order to reverse what the lower court, the appellate court, had ruled. And you have another strange situation. Hobby Lobby is also asking the Supreme Court to take the case. Now, why would they do that? At this point, they've won. Well, they've done it because they do not want their decision to be limited to their region covered by this appellate court, and they want the issue settled, believing that it is so important they actually agree with the Obama administration the Supreme Court should take the case and rule on it. Obviously, the Obama administration and Hobby Lobby and its legal team are hoping for equal and opposite decisions by the court, but they both are in agreement that the issue now must be decided by the United States Supreme Court. The technical issue before the court today is whether or not the justices, or a majority of the justices, will agree to release what is known as a writ of certiorari. That is the official legal notification by the court that it will hear the case and then render a decision. Speaking to the New York Times, Douglas Laycock, a law professor at the University of Virginia, very commonly cited and involved in religious liberty litigation, said, quote, "The stakes here, symbolically and politically, are very high." Similar legal experts have rendered the same judgment, and just about anyone looking at this situation knows that this is a huge question. As is the reality, as in so many of these religious liberty cases, the issue here is not just this case, this corporation, this set of particulars. It's the larger trajectory of the court's religious liberty rulings. In particular, the big issue that is perhaps most crucial to this case is whether or not corporations, such as Hobby Lobby, have religious liberty rights. Judge Timothy Tymkiewicz of the 10th U.S. Circuit Court of Appeals, in ruling for Hobby Lobby, stated, quote, "We see no reason the Supreme Court would recognize constitutional protection for a corporation's political expression, but not its religious expression," end quote. This is a case only the Supreme Court can eventually decide. But, as this judge's decision made very clear, the trajectory of the Supreme Court's logic in recent cases had been toward the very arguments being made by Hobby Lobby. If indeed the Supreme Court takes the case, as we believe it will set up a titanic legal battle between legal teams that have met before. And they have met before in the 2012 Supreme Court challenge to the Affordable Care Act itself. On the side of Hobby Lobby is a team of lawyers headed by Paul D. Clement, who was the 43rd Solicitor General of the United States. Representing the Obama administration will be the 48th Solicitor General of the United States, Donald B. Verrilli, Jr. They faced off before in the basic challenge to the Affordable Care Act, and it is likely they will face off again. Oh, one other issue, by the way. When the Solicitor General of the United States asked the Supreme Court to take a case, It usually does, because the Solicitor General is the official lawyer on behalf of the government of the United States of America. That should tell you something about what's at stake at the Supreme Court today. But what's at stake today just sets up the bigger question. What's at stake in the future when it comes to religious liberty? And not only for Hobby Lobby, and not only for corporations, but in the truest sense, for all of us. Speaking of legal action, last week we reported on the case of Frank Schaefer, that is the Reverend Frank Schaefer, who faced a trial not before a United States tribunal, but before a jury that was established by the United Methodist Church. This was a church trial, the trial of a United Methodist pastor in the state of Pennsylvania for having broken the discipline of his church and violated its rules by conducting a same-sex marriage ceremony. In this case, the same-sex marriage ceremony of his own son. As reporter Lisa Wangness of the Boston Globe reports, last week, 6 years after that ceremony, Pastor Schaefer was convicted at an emotional church trial in Pennsylvania for breaking church laws that forbid United Methodist clergy from performing same-sex weddings. The jury in that case responded with a 30-day suspension they imposed upon the pastor, and they told him that if he could not comply with church law, he must surrender his credentials as a clergyman. You'll recall that this pastor said that he could not comply with this before the judgment was reached, identifying the fact that three of his four children are gay. He said he would do it again if he had the opportunity. Wangsness reports on the obvious here, and that is that Schaefer's case is one of a number of similar cases making their way through the legal system of the United Methodist Church. As she writes, exposing a sharp rift within the nation's second largest Protestant denomination and raising questions about whether it can remain intact. The same point was made in recent days by Michelle Borstein to the Washington Post, who wrote, "The case is the first in what could be many trials as Methodist ministers who have been quietly conducting same-gender weddings become more bold, in part because legal same-sex marriage has led to more of their gay congregants to want to marry." Experts said that the denomination, remember that's the United Methodist Church, may be at a tipping point and that the verdict in the Schaefer case would be closely watched. Methodists, like much of American Christianity, they wrote, are divided over biblical authority and interpretation. Scott Campbell, a Methodist chaplain at Harvard University who's advising several of the pastors who have or have announced that they will conduct same-sex marriage ceremony, says, quote, "We are really standing on a precipice, and this verdict will set the tone." Well, the verdict is now in, and the verdict did set the tone. But the tone may indeed split the United Methodist Church. One reason for that is made very clear in Michelle Bornstein's article in the Washington Post. As she writes, there are now several people who will acknowledge that covert, don't ask, don't tell, same-sex marriage ceremonies are being conducted by many United Methodist clergy. Lisa Wangsness makes that very same point in the Boston Globe. She cites Alex Wood, Director of Communications for the New England Conference of the United Methodist Church, who said, quote, "If you look at Facebook and local newspapers, I think you'll see gay marriages performed by Methodist clergy are happening in Massachusetts and around the country." As the Globe explains, the church's law book, known as the Book of Discipline, declares that all people have sacred worth, but it calls the practice of homosexuality incompatible with church teaching. It prohibits self-avowed practicing homosexuals from serving as clergy and forbids clergy from officiating at same-sex unions. Very interesting language is being used in these articles in the secular press. For one thing, you have secular media openly aghast and puzzled by the fact that something that could be called a church trial is actually taking place. In other words, the secular mind finds it almost impossible to comprehend that a pastor might be fired for doing anything, or believing or teaching anything, or doing virtually anything. And the word trial, in the view of at least some, is prehistoric. That is according to the Boston Globe. The Washington Post coverage reveals a very similar incredulity on the part of many who are looking at this and scratching their heads and wondering, why would a denomination go to this kind of trouble? Why doesn't it just let these same-sex marriage ceremonies go on? Why won't the don't ask, don't tell policy work? Well, it now doesn't work for a very simple and profoundly obvious reason. They are asking, and they are telling. What we're looking at here is the fact that on Facebook and elsewhere, United Methodist clergy are not being quiet about the fact that they are conducting same-sex marriage ceremonies. And that means that conservatives can't ignore the fact that it is taking place. Because if it's taking place in the name of their church, they are implicitly and organically involved. This is a very important issue from a biblical perspective, and it points out the necessity of biblical church discipline in every denomination and in every church. Because if any church allows this kind of thing to go on in violation of the clear teachings of Scripture, it is accepting what it knows to be unbiblical, and it is accepting what it knows to violate Christian morality and Christian teaching. And in the case of the United Methodist Church, It runs into direct conflict with the stated principles of the church and its orders given to its clergy. The Washington Post gets to a very interesting aspect of this when it says that the trial reveals the case for two different concepts of Christianity. In their words, quote, one focused on preserving the rules that govern Methodism, the other prioritizing inclusion, end quote. Well, this is not a new story, is it? In fact, the realization that we're talking about two rival visions of Christianity is hardly new. Even back at the beginning of the 20th century, J. Gresham Machen, one of the most important Presbyterian figures of the 20th century, wrote a book entitled Christianity and Liberalism, in which he said Christianity, that is, Orthodox biblical Christianity, and theological liberalism are not two variants of one religion. They are two absolutely independent and different religions. Christianity and Liberalism, he said, by titling his book in that way, is a book about two different rival faiths. And those two faiths continue to be rivals, all the way down to this trial of a United Methodist pastor in the state of Pennsylvania. Other aspects of this case become abundantly clear. For one thing, you have the argument made in the Washington Post that the situation here is really complex. In other words, it's morally complex and difficult to understand. It's theologically complex. It takes theological experts to figure it out. Well, that's the problem for those who are trying to lead the United Methodist Church to endorse same-sex unions. Most of the people in the pew can understand the issue quite clearly, and they have figured it out, and they don't want their clergy violating scripture or the discipline of their church by conducting same-sex marriage ceremonies. The second issue comes down to the fact that what you're looking at here is the fact that the United Methodist Church is getting pressure from the one-third of the church in terms of membership that is now located not in the United States, but in the so-called Global South, in particular in Africa. And there, as the Boston Globe indicates very clearly, there is no sentiment whatsoever towards the normalization of homosexuality or the endorsement of same-sex unions. And the United Methodist Church may indeed find itself in the same situation as the larger Anglican Communion, and that is that you have two rival visions of Christianity within one denomination. But the difference here is that in the Anglican Communion, there may be no means whereby those conservatives in the Global South can actually make certain that the church maintains its stance in terms of orthodoxy and biblical principles of morality. In the United Methodist Church, however, it is true that now it is representatives in the Global South who are growing in number and in influence with every passing day. And for that reason, those who are trying to get that church to accept ministers conducting same-sex marriage ceremonies may have their last chance right now. Of course, as you look at this, you realize this isn't just about the United Methodist Church. It is about every church and every denomination that in its own way and at its own time is going to have to decide this issue and decide it with clarity. Shifting to the Church of England, two very big developments along similar lines. The first development is the church moving forward with the appointment and recognition of female bishops. Just about a year ago, the church's General Synod turned it down, reflecting again the fact that lay people had a great influence in that decision. But now, the bureaucracy of the church, the leadership of the church, responding to huge pressure from the secular world and even from the British government, is now moving forward to recognize and to appoint women bishops. This is a very interesting situation to the great disadvantage of evangelicals in the Church of England. In the other development, the Church of England has had to decide whether or not it will accept same-sex couples in terms of being listed as parents on the baptismal certificates of children. This is no small question, because on that baptismal certificate is the Church's official verdict of the relationship of those who are identified as the child or the baby's parents. As Thomas Kidd reports for World Magazine, this baptismal dispute reflects larger fractures over sexuality which threaten to break apart the Church of England globally. As he writes, the Archbishop of Canterbury, Justin Welby, has sought to balance the liberal stance of many Anglicans in Britain, Canada, and the United States with the conservative views of newer, thriving Anglican churches in places like sub-Saharan Africa, end quote. Well, there once again, we have the dynamic very much the same in exact parallel structure as in the United Methodist Church. But in the United Methodist Church, there is a greater likelihood that the conservatives will prevail. With every passing day, the United Methodist Church appears to be working in the opposite direction of most of liberal Protestantism, not becoming more liberal by the minute, but at least potentially becoming more conservative, with the assistance and influence of Christians from the Global South. Meanwhile, turning to Russia, Reuters is reporting from Moscow that Russian President Vladimir Putin has signed a law banning advertisements for abortion. That announcement came from the Kremlin just yesterday, A STEP activist said would infringe on the reproductive rights of women, while others are saying it's absolutely necessary to bring a curtailment of abortion in that country, or Russia is simply going to disappear. Russia is an anomaly on the world stage. It is the only nation where, for many years, there have been more abortions than live births. In fact, Russia has become the nation where abortion has been the way pregnancies are dealt with so routinely that the nation is about to disappear before our living eyes. And in response to that, Vladimir Putin has decided not to advertise or to allow advertisements for abortion. But we need to note that isn't a great convictional moral stance. What Russia needs more than anything else is a recovery of the understanding of the sanctity of human life. Until mothers want to have their babies, advertisements or not, they'll find their way to an abortionist. As Reuters reports, Putin has made stemming a post-Soviet population decline a priority during 14 years in power and struck a conservative tone in his new term, praising what he calls traditional values and holding up the Russian Orthodox Church as a moral guide. Well, it's not enough to be subtle here. It's not enough, clearly not enough, to say you can't advertise abortion. Until that government becomes very serious about upholding human rights and human life in terms of the inherent dignity and sanctity of every human life at every stage of development, it's going to ring as a very hollow and ineffective gesture when it just says abortionist can't advertise. About one thing, Reuters is profoundly right. You can trace this anti-human policy all the way back to the Soviet Union and even to the Stalinist era. It tells us a great deal about communism as a worldview, that it held that babies were the enemy and sought to do everything to try to bring everything under the control of the government. Keep that in mind when you realize that the government of China is still trying to do the very same thing. Even as in recent days it announced the possible modification of its one-child-only policy, it still intends by coercion to control the reproductive decisions of its own citizens. And it still intends by abortion, by infanticide if necessary, to limit the growth of the Chinese population. Even at the very same time that China's great danger is having too few, not too many, new mouths to feed. Thanks for listening to The Briefing. For more information, go to our website at albertmohler.com. You can follow me on Twitter by going to twitter.com/Albert Mohler. For information on the Southern Baptist Theological Seminary, go to sbts.edu. For information on Boyce College, just go to boycecollege.com. I'll meet you again tomorrow for The Briefing.